روحي فداكي واسمي شهيدك، دمي بيجري في دمي وريدك، صوتي الحر يا مصر نشيدك، انا انفاسك انا تنهيدك، انا نبضك نبض الجماهير، صوتك في ميدان التحرير، امل الثورة والتغيير، هرمك نيلك.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Marsis. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who is a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He is the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt Invading the Middle East and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks, Ian.
And Juan, it looks as though the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, SCAF, have decided to allow the winner of the election to win rather than face a violent backlash from the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, that was kind of touch and go because the military-backed candidate, Ahmed Shafiq, claimed last week that he had 51% of the votes. His tally was very different from that of the Muslim Brotherhood itself, which apparently had very good information from the 13,000 polling stations. The Brotherhood numbers gave their candidate, Mohamed Morsi, the lead at 52%, and that's what has been acknowledged today by the High Electoral Commission.
But it's as though the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces have already castrated Morsi, one by holding up the election results as though we're in charge and you're not, and we really can decide who is the next president. And prior to that, of course, the generals stripped the office of presidency of almost all of its authority under this military-issued interim constitution.
Right. The military has issued what is essentially an interim constitution defining some of the president's powers. I have to say that it's not right for the military to act in this high-handed fashion, but it is also the case that under the old system that Egypt had under Hosni Mubarak, the president was a dictator and could do pretty much anything he liked. And a lot of Egyptians were concerned that we went into this presidential election without a new constitution. The parliament was unable to successfully appoint a constituent assembly to write the new constitution in time. And so if Morsi took office under the old constitution or under the old set of practices, then he'd, you know, have all the powers that the dictator Mubarak had, and the point of the Egyptian revolution was that people were tired of dictatorship. So although the particular form of the limitation of his powers is disturbing insofar as it comes from the military, actually it's maybe not such a bad thing that he not be completely dictatorial.
Well, but you also have to add to the military's mendacity, if you will, having dissolved the democratically elected parliament, which the Brotherhood, of course, was the majority, and then the Salafists, funded by Saudi Arabia, were the surprise second winners. And so they're not exactly restrained in their desire to shape the results of Egypt's tentative and infant steps towards democracy.
Right. The parliamentary elections that were held in November and December of last fall produced a parliament that was about 46% Muslim Brotherhood, another over 20% held by the even more fundamentalist hardline Salafis. It was a strongly Muslim fundamentalist parliament. The issue there was that about a third of the seats of that parliament had been set aside for independence, and quite deliberately so, according to the electoral guidelines, which were approved in a national referendum. And the idea was that the old parties of Mubarak and the Muslim Brotherhood had been the ones you know, able to organize in the old days, and so would likely do well or dominate the new parliament. They wanted independents, fresh faces to have a chance. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis didn't respect that rule, and they put up party-backed candidates for the independent seats, who obviously won since they had party backing. And the Supreme Court found that that way of doing things was unconstitutional and ordered that the parliament be dissolved. And it's not entirely clear that the military orchestrated this move. I mean, there are serious legal substantive grounds for the ruling. The military was certainly delighted at the rule. And again, it's objectionable what the Supreme Court did, because, for instance, they could have ordered that third of seats to be reelected instead of dissolving the whole thing and throwing the parliament's legitimacy into doubt. But on the other hand, a Morsi president with unlimited powers and a Muslim Brotherhood parliament at this point in time would also have been a very unfortunate situation for Egypt.
Again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and the author of Engaging the Muslim World. In your latest book, Engaging the Muslim World, you have a chapter on the Muslim Brotherhood, and Mr. Morsi, the new president of Egypt, with, you know, somewhat dubious powers, but he's an American-educated engineer. He got his PhD here from the University of Southern California. He wasn't, neither he or Shafiq were the, I mean, the elections, because the center and the left split themselves, and the people that prosecuted the original revolution were marginalized. We ended up with fairly polarized results. He was certainly, Morsi is not considered the more moderate favorite, was he?
Oh, no. Morsi is a hardliner. He wants to implement a rigid and medieval form of Islamic law in Egypt. And he was up against a hardline authoritarian secularist in the Mubarak mold, General Ahmed Shafiq, an Air Force general, who threatened to stop all of these protests and restore law and order. So the Egyptian public really had a Hobson's choice here. And it was very unfortunate the way it developed. Actually, about a fifth of Egyptians voted for a labor left candidate, Hamdine Sabahi, who very nearly got into the runoffs. A lot of Egyptians voted for a liberal Muslim candidate, Abdul Munim Abu Futuh. But the way it was, the whole thing was done in the French way. You know, you have an initial election in which there are a lot of candidates. And the two with the top number of votes went into a runoff. They're not, in my view, a very fair way of doing things because that's a bit arbitrary. So the broad pluralist Egyptian public, the leftists, the labor people, the classic liberals, they were more or less excluded from this election. They had to choose between an authoritarian secularist or a hardline fundamentalist.
So, Juan Cole, what did you make of this group of secular political figures and lawmakers who call themselves liberals? They had a big televised news conference accusing the Brotherhood of hijacking the revolution and calling it a threat to the civil character of the state. I imagine amongst those who began the revolution, they feel quite bitter about what's happened. But I'm trying to figure out about who these people are, because this group apparently argued that the United States was behind the Brotherhood, which I find a little difficult to understand why you would have that kind of conspiracy theory that the U.S. wanted the Brotherhood. I know that's that's the same conspiracy theory in Iran, that the U.S. wanted the Ayatollah, but none of it makes much sense.
No, it's not true. Well, you know, the liberals in Egypt are not an unimportant quantity. The the classic liberals and the secularists are apparently about half of the electorate, if you count in the leftists. I think the revolutionaries who made this revolution, the young people who were in Tahrir Square in January and February of 2011, were mostly left of center. They wore blue jeans. They didn't have beards. They weren't Muslim fundamentalists. The Muslim fundamentalists came along for the ride eventually, but they weren't the ones who spearheaded the revolution. And the young revolutionaries, I think, again, had this difficult choice between a remnant of the old regime. Ahmed Shafiq was Hosni Mubarak's aviation minister and then his last prime minister, and a hardline Muslim fundamentalist. And neither one represented the revolutionary impulse. But I think a lot of the young revolutionaries, if they had to choose, either wasted their ballots. They wrote in a nonsensical phrase or a revolutionary slogan, or they actually held their nose and voted for Morsi, the fundamentalist candidate, because they were more afraid, that faction of them, of the return of an authoritarian military government than they were of the Brotherhood. And I think that's the outcome of the election in general. And the fact that the military was obviously acting very high-handedly in the days just before the presidential election may actually have helped to throw this election to the Brotherhood. Otherwise, Shafiq might have had more of a chance.
Does that mean, just in closing, Juan, that the good news is that the Brotherhood at least are check and balance against the military, even though they've been somewhat castrated in the process here by the SCAF? But the bad news is that the leader is a fundamentalist, and there's a lot of Saudis are pouring money in there. They want that. They want to go back to the medieval days, or Egypt to go back to the medieval days. What's your final feeling on which direction it's going to go in?
Well, it's going to be a struggle, and I think Egypt may be entering a time of pluralist politics. There is likely to be a new constitution and new parliamentary elections. This time, the left may do much better. The classic liberals may do much better. They'll have had more time to organize. And so Morsi is going to be, pushing for fundamentalist agendas, but he's going to have to do so probably in a pluralistic political environment. He's going to have to make deals with leftists, with liberals, and even with the generals who at the moment have the upper hand.
Well, and just in closing, Juan, as bad as it looks in Egypt for the people who brought about the revolution, having basically lost out to the extremes, things are looking pretty bad in Syria now, with the Turks are calling for a NATO meeting on Tuesday. Any quick comments on that?
Yeah, well, actually, Egypt is paradise compared to Syria. The Syrian regime continues to deploy tanks and heavy artillery against rebel positions in major city centers in the center of the country, in Hama and Homs. The scenes of just absolute destruction of apartment buildings for non-combatant civilians are being exposed to artillery fire is heart-wrenching. The regime increasingly is using Shiite, Alawite death squads against ordinary people to scare them into submission and is committing massacres. It's not true that those massacres have been committed in the main by the opposition. And so the situation is deteriorating. I don't personally think it's very likely that NATO will intervene. Russia and China are blocking that. I don't think NATO has the appetite for it.
Sure.
And so at the moment, it appears to be that Qatar and Saudi Arabia are sending in some rocket-propelled grenades and machine guns to the opposition.
Right.
So it's turning into a civil war, and it's reflecting a wider struggle in the region between Iran, which backs the regime, and Saudi Arabia, which backs the opposition.
Well, Juan Carlos, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and author of Engaging the Muslim World. He also has the informed comment blog at juancole.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.